So welcome to another episode of the Groundings Podcast. I have with me here today Max Isle, who is a doctoral candidate, as well as editor, writer, academic, activist, all around really, really incredible sort of person whose work I heavily recommend and will be linking a lot in the description of this episode. Today we're going to talk about sort of two essays of his and really grapple with agriculture, ecology, and where that sort of intersects with the socio-political and beyond. And I'm really excited because this is a field and a school of thoughts that I'm not well read in. So I'm just really excited to learn a lot. And I hope this episode is really educational and that the listeners learn a lot too. Before we continue, Max, I'm gonna let you go ahead and introduce yourself.
So first, thank you so much for having me on, Devin. I'm also very much looking forward to the conversation. I am a sociologist and economic development researcher. I do a lot of work on agriculture in the Middle East North Africa region, and in the past studying agriculture and peasant movements in Latin America, especially Venezuela and Brazil. And I am talking to you guys right now from Tunisia, where I am completing my doctoral research on the national liberation struggle, which maybe we'll get into it somewhat more during the conversation, but it was actually a quite violent national liberation struggle, and this is relatively unknown. So part of my work is showing that it actually required violence to break colonialism in Tunisia, and that it was kind of small peasants, landless people, herders, who were the ones who broke colonialism. And this is really kind of precursor or sets the stage for all my subsequent research, which is looking at how this class of people has been very much excluded from developmental projects on a global scale.
And that there's sort of a theme or I guess reoccurring notion that I think I've noticed in your work, where this decolonial violence or decolonial action is also heavily linked to thwarting environmental catastrophe. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that these forms of anti-colonial violence have only been partially consummated. And so this is fundamental for us to understand, is that decolonization has it needed violence for us to break colonialism, because you had to break the economic architecture of imperialism and the political architecture. And that architecture was only partially broken during the 1947 to 1980 periods, and of course is still ongoing in Palestine and through settler colonialism in the lands of the United States. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that this shift in the way the world is structured, it took certain means to break, and that's something that's worth bearing in mind.
We'll go ahead and get into first your essay, Beyond the Green New Deal. For the listeners, I'll definitely link this and any other essays mentioned in the description. I found this piece to be incredibly urgent in your tone of writing, but in a very sort of well-written and poetic almost kind of way. It was really moving and a great piece for me to read, because as I previously told you, due to my own anxiety, I've tried to just avoid even reading about climate change, and that entire topic feels anxiety inducing to me. But obviously, you know, that's, you can only do that for so long before you have to force yourself, and that's what this reading this was for me. Now, it's sort of this, it's sort of an implication or an indictment of the quote-unquote Green New Deal that we're hearing a lot about, and pundits, as you name, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have mentioned it, Naomi Klein has mentioned it, even people straight on the center right, like Cory Booker, have mentioned the Green New Deal. But I want to get your take on sort of what that even means, why it's problematic, how we can move beyond that, as your essay suggests, and get into a discussion on this essay.
I developed this critique of the Green New Deal totally coincidentally, just a bit before Ocasio-Cortez started really pushing it as the framework for what gets called a progressive response to climate change. And the idea of the Green New Deal is fundamentally is about green jobs, it's about green infrastructure, and it's about decarbonizing electricity generation. So in the first case, it is a program that's oriented towards the U.S. and can kind of be mimetically applied to the rest of the industrialized world, which is actually the rest in Europe especially is somewhat more advanced in decarbonizing its energy systems. Now, these are, of course, laudable efforts and should be undertaken, and the decarbonization of the energy system is imperative. But this idea of decarbonizing the energy system and green jobs and green retrofitting is, in essence, it's much like the original New Deal, its overall framework is ensuring that the climate crisis doesn't disturb the overall social formation of industrial capitalism. And insofar, and it basically is seeking to forge a kind of hegemonic bloc. And it's speaking to environmental organizers, potentially. It's speaking to this kind of left Bernie-cratism, although I would suggest that Bernie Sanders is kind of a, that's also a field of battle, in my opinion, less than a predetermined project. But it's also speaking to, it has behind it, I think, a lot of concerned members of the ruling class who are aware of the depth of the climate crisis and the fact that it has civilizational implications. And it's kind of trying to take all that energy to ensure that the overall project of a hierarchical system in the U.S. and, of course, more globally continues and is able to proceed unimpeded by this civilizational crisis of climate change. My critique of it is essentially twofold. I think in the first case is that people just have totally forgotten that the Green New Deal was the original New Deal was a defense of capitalism against a red, a communist labor insurgency in the United States. And of course, that communist labor insurgency was very much tied to the unspeakable these days, which is the Soviet Union. And what it was a means to protect this system of privatized accumulation from this upsurge. That is the first thing. The second thing that's very important to keep in mind is that it was in many ways, it was a managerial project. So it wasn't about increasing even domestically the popular participation in social, economic, and political life. It was about retooling things and kind of turning things into more a command and control system in which the state would take on more of the task of regulating capitalism in order to smooth out its kind of perturbations, its damage to the labor force, and so forth. So in order to kind of diffuse the threat of a red communist insurgency in the United States that was capable of posing a distinct threat to the capitalist order. The third major strand of criticism I have is that it is very much blind to the concerns of the global south and or the periphery or the third world, the poorer nations as a bloc. And those nations were never included during the Green, during the original New Deal, and they were the ones that had to put their own political and social and economic needs on the agenda through the anti-colonial and decolonial struggles. And that was something that occurred totally separate from the notion of the Green New Deal. And so insofar as the original New Deal, and insofar as the Green New Deal is a framing device for progressive politics, in its very structure of thought, it kind of walls off an international project, which brings together the peoples of the North and the South, and especially the laboring classes, into a common project with a shared horizon. And so I think in that sense, it of course reflects the current limits of internationalism in the U.S. context. It reflects the limits of the Bernie movement, of the Justice Democrats, and its popularity amongst many left publications. Of course, reflects, I think, their own foreshortened vision of who is included and who is excluded in their vision of the left or socialism or progressivism.
This is like a critically important critique, only because the momentum, right, with which the Green New Deal is gaining and is more and more entrenching itself in discussions of so-called, as you call out in the essay, quote-unquote eco-socialism, but still being entrenched in a Western epistemology or framework. Now, one of the things that you get into is sort of in the beginning, you have a fear that there's two different outcomes, if I'm not mistaken, where one of them is the people who can afford it, which is a very small few, will come out on the other side of this new Green Deal after a hypothetical catastrophe, who have built houses in the Alps and safe houses around the world. And of course, the rich will survive whatever is left of the earth to be survivable. And that'll be the future. It's a sort of hyper-capitalist hellhole that we're not far away from living. And on the other hand, you use this wonderful Cabral Amilcar Cabral wonderfully, essentially saying that on the other hand, we do all we can and we exert all human energy to rapidly reshaping the world. Did I sort of explain that correctly?
Definitely. I mean, I think there's also a slight middle ground, which is that we avert some of the ecological catastrophe, but not nearly enough of it. And that is what I fear a lot of the Green New Deal might ultimately be oriented towards. I mean, I think this touches on something fundamental, which the Green New Deal sidesteps, is that the ecological crisis, in fact, is not just a crisis currently of global warming, although that's so encompassing that understandably people are gathered around it and are worried about it, understandably. But there's other issues as well. There's mass die-offs of insects. The bee colonies are in crisis. They did some studies in a forest in Germany, and the bird count is and the insect count is far, far lower than it was even 20 years ago. And of course, there's increasing evidence that there's kind of chromosomal damage to human beings because of the amount of chemicals. So the ecological crisis is really becoming increasingly massive, and there's no check on that in the Green New Deal, which is kind of what I was talking about. I was talking about the continuity of industrial civilization, and the Green New Deal is a project to ensure the continuity of what passes, of course, for industrial civilization. Being the industrial civilization is of course, a project of exclusion. I think that contrasts totally with, you know, the horizon, of course, and the type of thinking that animated this kind of unique revolutionary Amilcar Cabral, who is unfortunately not so widely read as he should be. And this is brilliant, the way he is talking about bringing everybody into the struggle, the fact that he is clearly talking about what people can do, about the need to bring agricultural production under control, to increase agricultural production, to find a certain place for everybody. Very concretely map out the way that colonialism was extracting surplus value through its organization of agricultural production in the colonized world. I think this is all this notion that the colonized people, the project of national liberation, was about the recovery of the historical process of the colonized people. And of course, while making sure to ensure that people kept in mind that this was occurring at the amidst a core periphery or north-south division, and this cannot be forgotten under any means. And I think this idea, even independent of the question of agriculture, this idea of a mass mobilization and ownership of the struggle is very missing in a lot of the Green New Deal managerial discourse. I mean, it's kind of like, it basically is telling people that, that they should be a kind of passive pressure block in favor of decarbonization of the energy system, rather than people taking control over the society they live in order to fundamentally transform it. And a lot of it kind of makes its way into managerialism, even on portions of the eco-socialist left, or what is called the eco-socialist left, unfortunately.
So in that sense, the so-called eco-socialist left movement is almost completely ignoring the decolonial or anti-colonial movements or national liberation movements of the global south or the subaltern. And in that sense, if it never manages to incorporate that and to find that linkage, to listen to those voices, I guess, to use sort of popular terms of the day, then it's bound to fail. I know that I want to read a part of your essay and have you discuss it a little bit. You say, along these lines, we may recall that World War II and decolonization had something fundamental in common. They were violent. I am not arguing for a violent response to global climate change, but I do wish to note that capacity for politics by other means rested on massive mobilization. In fact, depending on the country, total mobilizations, full-scale reorganizations of human activity to achieve a common purpose. This is not to say that U.S. defense industrial spending has much in common with the often revolutionary effervescence which took over countries like Guinea-Bissau and China, but the, quote, mass mobilization of human energy on scales equivalent to wartime social activity, to use environmental historian Colin Duncan's analogy, which I am borrowing, speaks to what is needed. So we've touched on it a little bit already in this discussion, but talk to me a little bit about this mass mobilization and sort of the framing you use, and then you go into the Elysium analogy and example, which I thought was brilliant. Can you kind of discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. And if I can make just a small clarification about what I was talking about when I spoke of the kind of managerialism and also the North-oriented eco-socialisms, and it, mm-hmm. and it connects very much to this later point, I think because our left movements are not strong enough at the current moment to really set the agenda, and I think most people would agree with that, what you often have in the place is a kind of substitution of voice, if I can again use this term, voice, in which, you know, which is perpetual in the history, the modern history of the U.S. left, but where people are speaking in the name of movements without a connection to them, and to some extent without reflecting their ambitions. So if you look at, so I wouldn't want to tag eco-socialism with a blindness to the third world, but I just, I think there's some dominant articulations of it which do. And so what I'm thinking, for example, is that, you know, most eco-socialists are in fact highly attentive to the colonial question in the United States particularly. I mean, I think Standing Rock was a real powerful moment for most eco-socialists were paying a great deal of attention to it. And if you look at someone, for example, the kind of degrowth theorist, Serge Latouche, who pretty much coined this term, I believe, in France, he was a development economist dealing with issues of the third world and underdevelopment there. So I think it's important to maintain and even highlight that distinction between some forms of articulation, some forms of punditry about eco-socialism and the movements themselves, which can be, you know, a lot of them are very much interested in, I think, indigenous issues. Maybe to some extent in the U.S., they're somewhat less interested in questions of the external third world, which kind of, I do think, reflects a certain a breakdown of internationalism. And as this speaks of total mobilization, I mean, if you read any account, for example, William Hinton's Fan Shen about the Chinese Revolution and how the agrarian reform proceeded under Mao in the villages, the village he was taking field notes on, it's quite remarkable the degree of participation of the population in that process of restructuring the social domain and deciding what to do with the landlords, deciding what to do with the middle peasants, deciding how that would be, how land would be allocated, what would be just, what would be unjust. This was really a total takeover of this kind of decision of redistribution, which proceeded directly through popular empowerment and was popular empowerment itself. And it's very similar if you look at the types of agricultural improvements that were taken after the agrarian reform went in. There was kind of a massive process of soil enhancement. I mean, people had already been using these systems of fertility restoration in the soil, but they were intensified. Drainage systems were created, improved, renovated. Irrigation systems the same. And so all of this is about directly empowering or directly a social process, a social mobilization in which people have more control over the direct aspects of both production and the allocation of power in their lives. And this, I think, is a very appealing discourse that could be used more widely, but I think is at odds with the kind of looming technocracy that is embedded, in, of course, in Western social democracy. I mean, it's Western social democracy is like basically the modus operandi is like, okay, you can have the good life, but you won't decide how it goes. You know, you're going to get enough. And in certain places or certain people, certain regions, certain groups will get enough, but it won't be a process of taking control over both the process of change and what your life looks like afterwards. And I just think this contrasts so strongly with anyone who's actually studied the experience of revolutionary upheaval. And it also contrasts very strongly with the experience of just of anyone who's been involved in trying to organize anything ever, you know, let alone, you know, up to and including politics on campuses. You know, if you have 15 people in your group who are active cadre or active organizers, active activists who really are capable of thinking through all the issues, can defend their positions, and who are gifted with a wide array of skills and talents, then you could get so much more done than if you just have like kind of 15 people and 14 of them just show up to events and one person does all the work. I mean, anyone who's done politics knows this very well. So these contrasts in the patterns of social change also speak to different kinds of levels of transformation that are possible also.
And in another part of the essay, you say combining land use, livelihoods, labor, production, and consumption is central to systems change. Now, in this part of the essay, it seems like you're essentially, or at least in this sentence, I'll say, you're essentially getting to the idea that we have to approach this problem of climate change and of sort of ecological restoration in the most complex way as possible. And we have to incorporate the multiplicity or the layers of not just the land and the climate and nature, but how it intersects with labor and production and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of this, you know, I've always thought that agriculture kind of needed to be central to and is central to how the social formation is planned. What I'm kind of particularly departing from there also is thinking through another essay or another book, actually, of this environmental historian or agricultural historian, Colin Duncan, which is literally entitled The Centrality of Agriculture. And the argument is, first of all, basically that in order to have a sustainable civilization, you need to have a sustainable form of production. A sustainable form of production is agriculture. And insofar as you industrialize, and you should have some level of industrialization, then it should be not damage the system of food production, which is also not just food production, but also producing other forms of primary inputs. I mean, leather, wood, rocks, which are obviously a little different, but all of these are kind of emanating from natural processes and are essentially infinitely renewable. You know, these critiques of industrial civilization don't necessarily make their way into the discussions about the Green New Deal with enough frequency. But for example, we know that, for example, most of the goods we buy are built to be literally designed to be obsolescent. Mm-hmm. That they break very easily and you can't fix them. And then it takes a lot of energy to recycle them. And there's totally different other ways of planning things. You can plant more forests to make chairs, which you can then use as compost when they disintegrate and when the wood starts to rot. Or you can, you know, use petrochemicals to make plastic, which takes a lot of energy. So it's a madness how economically inefficient our civilization is set up at the current moment. So this is why I think that we need a more first. I mean, in general, we need, the climate question should be bundled with a more encompassing vision of social change. And in terms of re-embedding production or re-embedding all the forms of commodity production, which into sustainable forms of ecological production, while, of course, moving away from commodity production in the Marxist sense, moving away from capitalist production. And I think the kind of keystone of that is agriculture, which is kind of serially and notoriously neglected in large portions of the Western left, especially kind of if you consider kind of the high left or the arch left, because I don't want to make short shrift of the kind of hundreds or know, really thousands of leftist academics who are very interested in peasant issues and are very interested in ecological issues. But then there's kind of the realm of left politics, which we know very well, where people are not really discussing agricultural issues. It's not considered fancy. You know, people want to discuss value form theory and so forth, or the, you know, the Polish Revolution, etc. And these are certainly important issues, but not to the exclusion of the question of agriculture, which is actually, this is the fundamental question both of development for the entire third world, and it's also the question of how most people continue to make their lives. I mean, large portions of the two biggest countries on earth, I think at least, are still 50% or more rural and agricultural in India and China. And that needs to be central to their development strategy in the first place. And it is kind of not really talked about. There's also this kind of presumption that the rest of the countries of the global south can somehow, it's never clear how, approximate northern developmental paths. And I think this is Eurocentrism by definition. There's this assumption that, you know, a completed, you know, middle peasant or middle large peasant agricultural revolution can create the, you know, produce a capital surplus, which will lead to industrialization. And this is a totally fanciful notion of actually how industrialization happened in the first world. I mean, the first world first accumulated all its wealth by colonial drain from India, from the Caribbean, notoriously France, from Haiti. I mean, there was just massive amounts of capital exports, and in fact, large questions of genocide. And then even then, you couldn't find the good life for the population in places like France and England. And so you committed genocides in order to clear off enough land to put the populations, the surplus populations of Germany and England in the United States, or significant portions of the French population in Algeria. And then in the process, you murder 5 million Algerians. And this is actually, this is the actual history of industrialization in the global north. And this is very frequently omitted from kind of these notions of it, which rest on kind of fantastical social and economic histories.
And I think moving from there, I mean, you ask from that, you ask the perfect question. You say, what if we replace or minimally complement talk of a Green New Deal with something like a green consummation of national liberation? I mean, I think that's a fabulous and fantastic way of sort of turning that phrase, right, of sort of turning it from this preservation, essentially, of industrialization that the Green New Deal is. As you say, it doesn't fit for every locality, and it doesn't fit for every sort of community. But what if we could turn that conversation into one of a green national liberation and what that looks like? And you refer back to the Cabral reference. So can you speak to that a little bit? Because I'm interested in the point, especially where you say some may object that national liberation is a done deal, a political vessel foundered on the shoals of neocolonialism. And then, of course, you refer back to Cabral. So can you speak to that a little bit?
For sure. So there's a few interlinked issues that I'm kind of presenting there in what may be an almost too compact way. So the first issue is that it's speaking to this question of national liberation and what really people aimed at in terms of national liberation and what was and was not achieved. National liberation in the broadest sense was always about a complete expulsion of imperialism and very often of capitalism from the social formations of the global south. And now people kind of use the historical experience of national liberation against the kind of horizon of national liberation. And in the process, they say there is no longer a national question for the peoples of the global south, which would, of course, be very much news to countries like Iran and Venezuela, which are nations that are under sanctions, let alone countries like Iraq or Syria, which are have been invaded or are currently under military occupation with U.S. military bases on their sovereign territory. And you know, this is then kind of transmogrified into people accuse you of forming an apologetic for the indigenous bourgeois, And of course, this all just rests on a huge distortion of what was actually meant by national liberation, and what people very much understood. I mean, so if you look at the literature on how people understood colonialism was about people understood very clearly, you know, and you can read this in the literature of the anti-colonial ideologues, including bourgeois nationalists, like the ones who were running the Tunisian nationalist movement. It was very clear that colonialism was a process of surplus drain, surplus value extraction, meaning, you know, in the Marxist sense, that people, that capital in the North, capital formation in the North rested on extracting value from the labor and lands of the people in the global South. And colonialism itself, first of all, the decolonization itself only partially put an end to that process. And of course, Nkrumah, you know, identified the stage of neocolonialism and its aftermath. We know very well that the whites continued to hold the land in places like South Africa and Zimbabwe, not coincidentally, you know, which came under severe imperialist and Western left attack for having the audacity to redistribute the land to the black population. So this is something to keep in mind when this is kind of the broader frame in which I discuss this question of national liberation and colonialism. In terms of the green inflection, what I think is very much the point there is that the third world agricultural economies are capable of moving to a form of sustainable, infinitely sustainable, ecologically sustainable production relatively quickly, in very often forms of peasant farming systems, which I don't mean necessarily a social form of production, but I mean an ecological form of production, meaning they use the indigenous seeds, they aren't highly capitalized. These forms of production can move to a very productive and very surplus producing form of agroecology, or not only infinitely sustainable production, but in fact carbon dioxide absorbing production at a very rapid clip. And it's happened in many places. It's happened across Latin America. It's happened in Nicaragua. It's happened very quickly and with incredible success in Cuba. So when talking about a green consummation of national liberation, once these countries, once more and more countries of the South regain control, full control over their agricultural systems, embed them in the ecology, the mechanisms of capital, of surplus extraction, either by the native bourgeois or by the U.S., decrease markedly, because these people are producing a surplus on their own. You know, how are you going? It's going, you know, you can't sell them seeds. You can't sell them excess forms of mechanization they don't need. You don't own any intellectual property rights. They're highly productive agricultures because they're in warmer lands as opposed to the U.S. and Canada, where you can't grow most of the year. Across the, you know, as you get further and further south, you can grow better and better. So this means of control, which is making people rely on you for food, for example, will be eliminated, and these countries will not so much need quite as much as they do now from the North. I mean, I think, I was just interviewing Utsa Panayak, and she was just very forceful. She's an Indian economist, and she was very forceful about it. And she said, what does India need from the North? What can the North produce that India can't? And so talking about a green consummation of national liberation is a kind of compressed way of referring to this fact that these countries can move to an ecologically sustainable system and can also refuse to sell their goods to the North that they produce sustainably. And the North does not have such an easy way out. And I think that's important to keep in mind.
You gave some example locations, but can you go a little bit deeper on your examples and sort of explain what that shift or switch looks like and how to more materially understand and grasp what you're saying? Because I don't want listeners to listen and think that this sounds too theoretical.
Absolutely. So the fundamental two examples where this has taken place on either national scales or widespread regional scales are the zero budget natural farming movement in India, where in a span of a few years, people were able to shift agricultural production technologies from kind of standard input intensive, meaning chemicals, pesticides, excess mechanization, to forms of agroecological farming, which means zero inputs, no pesticides, using organic ways or natural ways to restore fertility of the soil, improving soil structure, polycultures, meaning planting multiple things that kind of enhance one another's productivity when you plant them in the same field. So in India, this happened and has involved hundreds of thousands of Indian farmers. And so it's on quite a mass scale. In Cuba, it's also been remarkably successful, starting from 1988, then through 2008, the overall production in the peasant sector, in the smallholder sector, increased, I think, by 100 or 150%, while input use was reduced, and in fact, labor in some places, the amount of labor that went in was reduced. And when we talk about this agroecological transition, we mean that people shifted from forms of farming that require what we now understand as industrialized farming to forms of farming that are more or less enclosed on the farm, but aren't socially enclosed. So they rest on people talking to one another and learning what the new technique is, trying it out, being shown it by their fellow farmer, their fellow peasant, their comrade, and then expanding it and testing it out and seeing that it works. And this is how you expand things on a countrywide scale incredibly quickly. So it's very important that people understand this is not an abstract at all. It actually has been achieved with remarkable success in certain regions of the world. And one of the main issues is that it hasn't been that a lot of there isn't enough support and there isn't for replicating this experience. I think that this is very important to keep in mind as we consider this kind of, this question of agroecology, that it's a very much a proven technology for improving the ecological sustainability of agriculture while maintaining or even increasing yields on a per land unit basis.
Mm-hmm. I guess my question then is, how would this sort of impact the city communities and city communities and their those localities, and in what ways would that be a conflict or challenge to overcome?
I think it's a central question to kind of offer some semblance of an answer to, although I would be cautious and say that, you know, it's very much something to be worked out on the ground through a popular project. In this sense, I think that part of restoring are putting this notion on the agenda is being able to talk very clearly to people in various places and think about what a long-term development model looks like, which is why I was talking about it being something that emerges through a concrete practice of national development rather than an abstraction. But what is a way for a country like Jamaica to make the entire population no longer poor? To give everybody in the entire country a decent life. I mean, that's the question. That's the classic question in many ways of communism. Like, how do you give everybody bread and justice and also unalienated production? How do you give everybody a good life? What is the vision of a good life? And it's true that agriculture is not on the agenda, but also it's true in many ways that this idea, to call it in kind of highfalutin terms, the communist horizon is also not on the agenda in most places of the world anymore. And so the question is how to get these things back on the agenda. How can we state to people that we have, all of us in our different places and ways, have a socio-political project or an ambition to offer a good life to everybody who wants it. This is this is a huge, huge, huge civilizational question, and is to some extent that's why I'm just kind of sketching out that the technical issue is not the obstacle. The issue is the the social issue and it's the political issue. And I guess in terms of kind of a few counterexamples, you know, I think there has been some, the landless workers movement in Brazil has had some success in getting people from the cities to move from the slums, in fact, not the cities per se, to move back to the countryside. And if, you know, there, because land reform is very much on the agenda right now in South Africa, there is a very substantial portion of the people living in the slums of, you know, Johannesburg and Cape Town who are interested in an agrarian reform and getting their own plot of land and then moving back to the countryside with the ambition, of course, that they can construct a decent life there. I think that, you know, each country, it's part of the forging of a political project in each country or each region. And I don't think it's easy at all. You know, I don't have any real substantive answers for how that might be accomplished in Jamaica, a country I really don't know well at all. You know, I think it's hard. I think, you know, if you look at the experience of Cooperation Jackson, that's been a lot of hard work. But to try to say, okay, there is, let's put in place farming as one of the aspects of building up sustainable cooperative infrastructure in the southern city as part of a broader restructuring of regional and national political economy. I think these are massive, difficult political projects. And one of the obstacles to them, from my perspective, is even getting them on board on the left itself, where people are kind of like studying Lord knows what. But what they're not interested in is the form of production that, in my opinion, is necessary for most people on the planet to have a good life.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a great answer to a sort of unfair and big question that I asked you. and I'm really glad you mentioned Jackson in reference to Jackson, Mississippi, I assume, where that, I think, was a really good, you've written a good piece that's, I think it's titled Socialist Strategy or Socialist Southern Strategy in Jackson, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Although I give my colleague Wendell Marsh credit for this brilliant title.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a great piece as well. And for those of you who don't know, there's essentially this led by the New African People's Movement, I believe. I need to do my own reading on the Jackson movement, but there's sort of this autonomous region of Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi, that's to me in the process of being carved out, not without its own problematic tendencies or difficulties, that is being heavily ignored by the Western left, that I think we need to pay a little bit more attention to. So I'm glad that you brought that up, and I hope my listeners can go and, you know, dig a little bit deeper and further into that. Of course, we don't have too much time left. I don't want to keep you forever, but this is just like a really interesting and crucial conversation. I feel like I'm learning so much. So moving from there, another piece of yours I wanted to talk on briefly, and we could really talk about the Green New Deal and your piece on about moving beyond that. We could talk about that all day long. There's another piece of yours, which I admittedly have not finished reading, but I'm very interested in. You sent it my way. It's called Delinking Food Sovereignty and Populist Agronomy, Agronomy, Notes on Intellectual History of the Peasant Path in the Global South. This is a really fascinating piece. You're building onto some of the work of Samir Amin and some really sort of, to me, reading this felt very cutting edge only because it's sort of outside of my own discipline and my own area of reading that I normally go towards. But it also felt important. And even though it is a bit more academic than the other piece, I still felt that same sort of urgency and immediacy in your tone, which I think is, you know, a mark of a writer that's lost nowadays. So can you sort of give me the brief overview of what you're trying to do in this essay, what you're arguing, and of course, just for listeners, I will also link this essay as well in the description.
So what I was doing in that essay, which developed out of two talks I gave for colleagues here in Tunisia, Karina Mullen and Habib Ayab, and the latter was at a forum discussing food sovereignty here in Tunisia, was to bring together three intellectual currents and also political currents that were looking at questions of what does development models look like and how does agriculture figure into development models in the global south. So the first one, delinking, was forged by Samir Amin, the recently deceased Egyptian economist. and then developed further by Fawzi Mansour and also others. And what Amin sought to do with this framework was to show that the countries of the South could not develop through a process of interlinked development. That is, if they were to thinking that they could kind of leverage themselves into full inclusion as part of the world system and develop on a path somewhat similar to that of the North, that this was not possible. It was not possible for one reason, because they faced an enormous political, social, and economic assault from the North as they tried to do it. But the other reason it wasn't possible was because it wasn't, it accepted too much of the valuation of the North. That is, it accepted that the sectors which would develop in the South would very often be ones which would complement the economies of the North. So that if the North wanted to produce textiles more cheaply, okay, then the South would say, okay, we have an abundant labor force and we can, the skilled labor force that's capable of taking in those industries, we'll be the ones to handle that and incorporate ourselves into that value chain. Or if you're producing excess cereals, okay, then we can adjust our economy so that we don't pay our farmers very well, and instead, we will take advantage of the cheap cereals you give us in order to actually offer our comparative advantage on the labor market, which would then be cheap labor because our you're selling us cereals at below price. And so this, Samir Amin said, okay, there's no possible way to develop in those terms. What you're going to have to do is de-link, which means break from that kind of law of value or kind of buffet or menu of choices which are placed in front of southern countries by the North, and instead evolve a system of production according to their own law of value that was substantially based on making sure that both rural people and urban people were compensated fairly for their labor and were compensated equally for their labor. And that if you did that, you would have a much more sustained path of development. And of course, you know, let me just highlight there, and to emphasize the continuity with the other two options, other two paths I'm going to discuss, is of course that meant if you're compensating agricultural workers or farmers the same as urban industrial workers, you're going to have a lot less rural urban migration, and then people are assured good lives in the countryside. The second kind of strain of analysis I looked at was food sovereignty, which was started being used in the 80s in Mexico and then kind of really blew up in the mid-90s through the work of La Via Campesina, which is a worldwide peasant coordinator, a coordinator of hundreds and hundreds of national-level peasant movements. And they look at food sovereignty as the kind of the national sovereign control of the food system using ecological forms of farming. And they're extremely active in Latin America and the landless workers movement, very active in South Asia and Southeast Asia, across sub-Saharan Africa. There's branches in Europe. There's very few branches in North Africa and Palestine. And they kind of have a vision of food sovereignty, which is making the question of rural sustainable smallholder production, food production, central to a wider development model or a wider project. So I looked at, that was the second strand I looked at. And then I looked at the kind of how these radical agronomists and radical economists developed this idea of Tunisian delinking more concretely. So what proposals did they put forward for Tunisia to change its economic architecture, to change its agricultural planning agencies, to change how the state interacted with the peasants, again, in order to make agriculture, especially smallholder agriculture, put that at the center of state development policy. And what that really meant, again, and this is a lot like what it looked like for delinking and also for food sovereignty, it was about a return to the peasant and valorizing and elevating the value of peasant technologies above all, meaning kind of indigenous forms of water harvesting, which were infinitely sustainable and very necessary in a place like Tunisia, which is for most of it, which is doesn't receive a lot of rainfall. Which meant using local seeds instead of using imported seeds, which meant using forms of soil fertility restoration, which didn't rely on imported fertilizers. And so it was looking at those three paths of possible development and then also kind of juxtaposing them against what is called the national question, or whether or not countries face, whether or not nations face any sort of question as a unit, or kind of looking at those three models as they confront the question of violence from the global north, which is obviously absolutely fundamental to development in the whole world, but especially to development in the Middle East, North Africa region, where, you know, what the U.S. is carrying out in Syria and Yemen is in fact not development policies, but de-development. You know, it's actually lowering the level of life for people in the region. And so it looked at those three paths and then kind of put them in the framework of the violence people are facing in the region.
Now, I want to make note, because this podcast is sort of sponsored by and in the vein of the Walter Rodney family. So Samir Amin, he has said before he's deeply inspired by Walter Rodney and how Europe underdeveloped Africa. So when I hear you speak of delinking, and especially the way that Samir Amin was able to sort of distinguish it from the broad field of work that existed before that touched on similar themes but never actually dived into them or elaborated, can you speak a little bit about how delinking and the sort of theory of delinking, how one, as you bring up, it doesn't mean I think you use the word sealed away or cut away from global trade and technology and connections, but also how this theory compares to, or is similar to, maybe underdevelopment theory as purported by people like Rodney.
So I think these were very much lines of inquiry that were not only developing in parallel, but you can be sure that that Walter Rodney and Samir Amin knew each other and were probably, I'm sure, often at the same congresses and meetings and possibly corresponded with one another. I don't know.
Oh yeah, but definitely. The Rodney family has actually correspondence, I believe. I don't want to be mistaken, so I'm going to say I'm pretty sure, of Rodney and a number of very prominent intellectuals that have just never been publicized, that they kind of hold in their own personal archives. And I believe Samir was one of them. But I'll have to get confirmation on that and get back to you. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's the case, because I think this was a common project. So what Walter Rodney was, as you know well, and perhaps your listeners know, was doing with how Europe underdeveloped Africa, he was showing how the process, the historical constitution of Europe and Africa, was an interlinked process. So that there was a process of slave raids, there was a process of enslavement, and actually taking bodies from where they had been nourished by Africa and bringing them into capitalist production in the north. It was a question of resource extraction. It was a question of restructuring African agriculture to make it fit the needs of Europe. It was a question of profiting from the commodities of Africa and making sure that the African peoples were not benefiting from the proceeds of their agricultural labor. It was all these ways that to say that the development of Europe and the underdevelopment of Africa were not parallel, but were formed one historical unity, right? Mm-hmm. And this is what Samir Amin was arguing as well. He was this was his argument about the core and the periphery, in that the core, like Europe, and the periphery, Africa, including North Africa, Latin America, nearly all of Asia, they were part of one interlinked process of accumulation on a world scale, and therefore one constituted the other. And so I think that they were talking about exactly the same thing. I mean, here, of course, like here and there, they're going to differ about certain mechanisms and certain policies, certain historical periods and certain regions. You know, they weren't the same person. They were offering their own takes on what was going on in Africa. But their methodology, their mode of analysis was very much the same. And what delinking proposed was that these countries had to find a way to break off their policies, their developmental paths, from this logic imposed upon them by the global north, because that had only brought ruin upon those countries. And of course, the corollary, which Samir Amin always pushed, was that the you know, there had to be movements in the North which would agitate against the intervention of those countries into the affairs of the Global South when they tried to carry out their own policies too.
So delinking essentially can be thought of as a means of a way to essentially, in the most basic of terms, stop the excessive, exploitive, or almost completely in some cases, flow of capital from the Global South to the Global North. Am I correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
You say in the essay, quote, clearly delinking in a world of poor peasants meant a peasant-centered developmental process alongside massive land reforms. In what ways is the action of delinking or and the theory, right, of both of the same are being sort of expanded and built upon currently in today's political economy?
I think that at the national level, I mean, delinking, as Amin understood it, was about a sovereign popular project, meaning that it was a country carrying out its own political and economic and social agenda and doing so at odds with the kind of agenda requested by the Global North or the law of value of the Global North. So in some sense, one can, you know, at a preliminary level, decisions like that of Venezuela to decide to put in place health programs instead of, you know, the oil money going to middle-class consumerism, which was actually, you know, buying commodities from Miami primarily, that was a very preliminary step towards a national sovereign project. But I think you see a more concrete experiment with delinking, not really at the national level, given this kind of massive assault on the Global South and on these independent projects, which we've seen since the late 90s. I mean, any country that tried to do anything against the U.S. wishes was just really hammered. And so I think the most substantive experiments have been carried out locally. I mean, in Nicaragua, for example, they're not food dependent. They are fully food independent. They produce all of their own food. Nobody knows this about Nicaragua, really. And it's not even talked about. You know, people are talking too much about Nicaraguan voices and Nicaraguan agency. But actually, the Nicaraguan agency is being exerted quite strongly in that the country is food sovereign. And there has been massive transformations in smallholder farming practices over the last 15 years, such that not only is it producing its own food, but there's been a widespread move to more ecological forms of production methods, which is a remarkable thing that has happened in total, not silence, but in perhaps ignorance of people who might be interested in bringing this to our attention more broadly. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very important example. I mean, I think another example is take Iran, which very substantially has built up a university infrastructure since 1979 in a very remarkable way. The production of scientific papers from Iran in the post-1979 period has increased almost exponentially. And it's one of the largest, I think, per capita producers of scientific publications on the planet. This is a process of asserting control over its own intellectual property, over the technical or technological means of economic development in the service of being able to decide. So it's not having to rely on the intellectual labor of the Global North. And I think this is one of the remarkable achievements of 1979, of the revolution, which again is very seldom discussed. And you have these lights along with the shadows in many countries of the world that are kind of flashpoints of independent development that's delinked from the patterns of value imposed from the North and that generally aren't woven into a coherent developmental model in most any country in the world at the current moment. But that is a reflection of the pressures in many ways, both, of course, there's been internal mistakes and there's internal issues, but they also are facing a massive counter-revolutionary attack from the North that's preventing moves in that direction as well.
And as I hear you talk about this, I'm instantly reminded of Thomas Sankara's Burkina Faso and, you know, how in 4 years they were able to declare food self-sufficiency through sort of a massive overhaul of land redistribution, national liberation. Wheat production had increased, you know, trifold and so forth. I guess the examples, as you say, they are very much so in the locality. And I think that any nation that is attempting at this sort of massive scale level of food self-sufficiency, or I say massive scale because that's sort of how we have to think of it in a world where it is against the norm or against the grain, to be cheeky, but are instantly assaulted by the global north. And I think that there is sort of a pushback to the idea of food self-sufficiency because it does throw off that toxic colonial, neocolonial relationship that still exists globally. Is there sort of a backlash or like an imperialist aggression that comes with moving towards food self-sufficiency and the act of delinking?
Absolutely. Here we have to understand a little bit about how the world food system is constituted. There's a lot of distinct kind of flows or types of food and agricultural goods which go in distinct directions. But the North is really only good at producing cereals, and it uses those cereals to undermine third world food self-sufficiency, so that countries across Africa, Yemen, notably in the current context, Venezuela, are reliant on other countries to import food for their food supplies. And this is a mechanism of undermining the sovereignty of these countries. And can be used indeed as a weapon, as is currently happening in Yemen, as we know very well. So that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is that in undermining, for example, the primary nutritional sectors, like the cereal sectors, what land is diverted to are specific export sectors of things that the global north wants the south to produce. And it cannot produce itself. That's things like tea, coffee, tropical fruits, tropical vegetables, all forms of fruits and vegetables which can't be produced in winter except in greenhouses in the U.S., can be produced year-round in the global south. All of these products can be produced very cheaply, sometimes with multiple harvests, with minimal labor input and kind of under ideal growing conditions in the global south. And so the U.S. wants those countries to divert cropland to the production of those goods. So you take a country like India, and I'm drawing here on the fabulous work, very technical and complicated, but fabulous, of Utsav Patnaik and Prabhat Patnaik, their theory of imperialism. What they show is that during the colonial period, Indian food grain consumption and production went down markedly until it hit an absolute low in 1947, because land was diverted to these tropical crops that the US and Europe could not grow. Then until 1991, which is when neoliberalism hit, or a second colonialism, it went up again very sharply, food grain production. At that point, it started to go down again because the U.S. imposed through neoliberalism this idea of comparative advantage, that India had comparative advantage, so-called, in tropical food production and tropical goods production, and didn't have it in cereal production, so it should produce these products, the tropical goods, and send them to the north. And of course, this has been disastrous for the Indian poor people, who not only overall are in a hunger crisis and are actually consuming less and less, but secondly, are actually killing themselves. There's been a huge spate of farmer suicides in India over the last 20 or 30 years. It's been hundreds of thousands, right? Which no one talks about. Well, they're busy talking about the babies in Kuwait being thrown out of incubators, but don't talk about these suicides that are being imposed through structural adjustment on India. So the control over the food system in the global south is actually fundamental to controlling the entire form of production and consumption. You know, that these things can't be separated from one another, especially in these agricultural countries where they produce something that we cannot produce in the colder countries. So what would happen if all these countries' food systems escaped the control of, we're no longer under the indirect but very real control of the global north, is suddenly what would northern supermarket shelves look like? It would be a huge issue. So this is actually fundamental to the control of, to the overall accumulation on a world scale, I think.
And I want to ask, because you do bring this up briefly, you mention in the essay, you say, quote, if a global South state were to carry out a radical agrarian reform, unless exchange controls were in place, there would be capital flight. It is likely that there would be more flagrant coercion to push for a policy reversal. I guess my question is, in what sense does capital flight play into all of this? Because I imagine we know that there's still today single or handful crop economies that exist who the capital generated, the abysmal capital generated from these crops, from the global north, is essentially the founding block of their economy. So if such a reform, or as we used earlier, sort of green national liberation were to take place, would capital flight play a large key into hindering that, or be a massive challenge? And the second part of that question is, does the theory of delinking sort of address that capital flight?
So Samir Amin did not devote himself too much to this question of capital flight in delinking per se, but there are certainly countries that put in place capital controls before it became necessary to do so. And once you've put in place the capital controls, then you're in a much better situation to prevent capital from leaving. If you put them in after the fact, then a lot of the capital has left already, and you're screwed. But the countries that are able to keep the capital in the country are able to keep the native industry running, are able to mobilize that savings for state ends, to force people to, they can force the upper class in effect to invest in state treasuries, which then gives the government funding, the capital in order to carry out kind of development project. So this question of capital flight was massive. I mean, I know the country I know best in Tunisia, you know, they, as soon as they were declared independence in 1956, there was massive capital flight from both French and also native capital. And this made things, in fact, the economic situation got worse from 1956 to 1958 or 59. And the country was under just a severe threat. And the depressions worsened, the economic misery and depression worsened during that period. So it's just a fundamental challenge to really any country that's trying to carry out development program. And this is actually very funny. If you, both Bolivia and to a lesser extent, Venezuela, built up massive capital reserves, which meant that they could defend their currency from speculative attacks, which they sensed were occurring. And because they had these currency reserves built up, the amount of speculative attacks, especially that Bolivia endured during the Morales period, hasn't been very egregious. And this has been a kind of means of self-defense for the country to carry out state welfare, to carry out macroeconomic management, in order for things to be stable enough for the country to govern and not be deposed by a kind of color revolution or something. So these questions of macroeconomic architecture are actually massive. And it's funny also that if you, there's portions of the Western left that chastise them for carrying out what they call orthodox macroeconomic policies of building up enough foreign exchange in their central bank to protect the currency. And this just goes to show you that these people have no connection to reality. I think that these types of issues, currency controls and foreign exchange controls, are totally fundamental to any sort of sovereign project in the global south. And it's definitely something that has been on the agenda from, you know, 1945 onwards, in fact.
Well, I would love to continue talking with you on this subject. I know we didn't get through all of your second essay. One last question before you go, and before I ask you to tell people where to find you, I want to ask, what are the connections between the two essays? I mean, I know both sort of deal with the ecological questions as they intersect with the national question, but I want to sort of get your opinion on how the two, sort of this critique of the Green New Deal and the ideas of delinking and food sovereignty, how those two conversations and theories you propose can be meshed together in your opinion.
Totally. So I think in essence, the two essays depart from the two main organizing questions which structure a lot of my work, which is kind of the agrarian question and the national question. And what I want to do with both of these essays is to first kind of restore analytically and theoretically the role of the smallholder peasantry to the debate on development. I mean, for me, the debate on development and the debate about both the Green New Deal and food sovereignty, these are debates about development. These debates on development, I think, need to depart from the centrality, not just of agriculture, but of smallholder agriculture for the countries of the formerly colonized world. I think this is absolutely fundamental and is very much absent in a lot of discussion. I think the second fundamental problematic is the national question, or do these nations, you could say, does the nation of Tunisia or does the nation of Venezuela, do these face questions, developmental and political questions that are structured in national terms? And this is something that is very foreign to, that people don't really want to discuss. They're like, okay, well, why don't we all just band together, workers of the world unite? I think it's a good idea for workers of the world unite, but workers of the world unite need to unite from their distinct locations and the distinct problems that those locations pose. It doesn't mean, so if workers of the world unite in from India and China, actually, most workers are peasants. So how's the development path going to reflect their interest as peasants? What if workers of the world unite in the north are used to being able to exploit the peasantry of the global south to be able to make sure that they have oranges and bananas in midwinter? Okay, you have a problem. I think that problem is reconcilable, but the problem has to be put out in front of us in order for it to be reconciled. And if it's not put out in front as something that's potentially a line of division, then you can't possibly resolve it, and then you end up with a very, what in my opinion ends up being a very parochial conversation, therefore a parochial political horizon.
The questions that you raise with your work are massively important. I mean, just in the past 48 hours of reading these two essays, rereading one of them and then reading the delinking one for the first time, has sort of reoriented and reshifted a lot of my thoughts and my thinking. And so I want to thank you for your work as well as for your time in this interview. If you could just tell people where they can find you, and if there's anything else you want to mention or shout out, the floor is yours.
Yeah, so people can find my written work if they like, usually on my Twitter account, which is AJL_Max, and I post all my new writing there. It's also available on my academia account or on my website, www.maxile.com. Yeah, my email's there if someone wants to hit me up with any questions, comments. Generally, it's been a really interesting conversation, and I appreciate you taking the time out of your afternoon to have me on.
Yeah, definitely. And I want to make note to all the listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to, if you're able to, if you want to support me on Patreon at patreon.com/halfatlanta. Thank you, Max.
Thank you.